Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team. The part of Tor today will be played by the table that the mic is sitting on, so he's probably going to be a little bit silent. And today we are here with...
Huynh Duet Dao.
I have been totally mispronouncing that all this time.
People have been mispronouncing my name my entire life, and it's actually a funny story. My mom told me when I was young that, you know, my family's Vietnamese, and when I was born, she wanted to pick a name that was easy to pronounce.
Oops.
And I think she picked a name that was easy to pronounce in Vietnamese. But Vietnamese is all like tone and diphthong, so she picked something with a tone and a diphthong, and so I've basically been saying, yeah, whatever, just close enough. Like,
Were you in Vietnam at the time?
So no, I was born here.
Okay.
I think she was kind of skewed to what was easy for her as opposed to what was easy for everybody else. But yeah,
she's going to say your name more than anybody else, so I guess it works.
Yeah, she did. So mostly in a yelly kind of like high pitched kind of like.
Oh, I should try to yell your name instead. Maybe it would come
out
natural.
Yeah, that might work. That might just sound kind of like more kind of heartwarming and kind of like, you know, like, yeah, very familiar.
And angry.
Angry.
Hey, you sound like my mother. So we are here today at there's a GDE summit, which is a once annual, twice annual. It's a every now and then thing where GDEs get together, Google Developer Experts,
mm-hmm.
With capital letters, get together to get together and learn about stuff. So there's one of those happening in Santa Clara, and I thought since it was here, I should talk to about random stuff that you work on. So I have gotten to know you over the years through conferences, because that's sort of where I meet external developers.
Yeah.
Because you're not in the halls of the Android building where I work. So places like DroidCon in London as well as San Francisco, probably.
Yeah, and 360 and Dev.
360 and Dev, which is an awesome new conference this last summer. And next summer, right?
Yeah, next summer.
Okay,
in
I saw
July
they're planning
again,
on doing that.
Think, yeah.
Same venue?
Yep. Well, okay. No, actually, I don't know about that.
Denver anyway,
yeah,
okay.
For sure.
So that'll be good. Yeah, it's really cool, the new conferences that are cropping up in the last 3 years. Like originally it was, you could get Android content at Google I.O. and that was it. And it was just a minority of the content there in incredibly overcrowded rooms. And then and DevCon came online.
Right, yeah.
Sort of more kind of businessy media focused stuff. And then some more sort of techie driven conferences came online, like Big Android Barbecue started doing developer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
DroidCon started franchising all over the world.
Yeah, they're everywhere now. They're like Starbucks, the Starbucks of Android conferences. It's amazing though, in a good way.
Yes. I mean, it is good. Like the conferences that I enjoy the most are the ones that are driven by developers. And clearly, and it may vary based on the DroidCon since it is franchised. I don't think they completely control that, but at least the ones I've been involved in and heard about, which are certainly London. San Francisco was new last year, so we'll see where that develops, how that develops. The New York one I've heard very good things about, because these are all driven by companies that do Android development, mm-hmm. so they've kind of got the right hats on to
Yeah, and GDDs and communities as well. And I think those are always my favorite. And like, you know, I don't want to rag on like, you know, other, you know, because I think I first spoke at like AndevCon. All the names are so close. I'm trying to make sure that I don't mix up AndEv with AndevCon. But like, you know, and definitely like I feel like the AndevCon is definitely focused on training, which is important. But I think like having the community and having people driving it and driving content, and like so just it just feels more welcoming. Like, hey, like we're just gonna come and hang out and talk about this really nerdy thing that we like called Android. So the DroidCons are amazing.
Yeah, I mean certainly the selection of speakers and content, like there's always something good to go to at every hour of the day, probably more than one thing, so then you can catch up afterwards. So the other key to a really good developer conference for me, especially since I do not get out of my building very often, is will it be recorded? Right. So if I'm gonna give this presentation once because that's really the only time I have to give it, or it's, you know, time-based content like, you know, what's new in N or what's new in 7.1 or whatever, like I would like to give this content. I've spent a fair amount of time sort of putting it together to create this mental model for what's going on in the platform or a particular technology area, and then for that to be able to scale to the people that couldn't make it to the conference, I think
mm-hmm.
is key.
Yeah.
How it works out financially for these people, I don't understand, because like Google I.O., you could not get a ticket for I.O. and feel really unhappy about it, but like 10 hours later, you can go online and watch all of that content for free,
yeah.
right? Which is awesome. What you don't get is like the networking capability of the conferences and hanging out and meeting other people that are doing the same thing. I think that's huge,
mm-hmm.
but at least you can get the content out there. And places like DroidCon and 360 and Dev did mm-hmm. that last year. And I think that's kind of it's a checkbox item for good developer conferences now, is record the content, because that allows the speakers to scale their content out there, unless they want to make money on given talks.
But
then it doesn't work at all.
I think it's actually standard now, and I feel like even within the community, we've had this debate on whether recording is a good thing. You know, trying to like, it's kind of like the saying, like, well, you know, encouraging people to buy a ticket. Like, they don't want to discourage people from actually going because the content's free later, because obviously ticket sales are good for keeping the Joy-Cons going. But then also this idea of like, well, you know, like, you know, you should, you know, participate in the conference, you know, you should try to just, you know, attend and pay attention. Whereas videos kind of give you a little bit of like wiggle room for that. But I really do believe that it's important to have the videos, because not everybody can go to the conference. Not everybody can afford it. Not everybody has like the time and the schedule in their life to do that. So I don't know. I think it's standard. And I think I definitely agree. Like, if I heard that videos aren't being recorded, I'm kind of like, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a factor. But
I mean, it certainly helps with the international audience too, which is huge for a platform like Android. Like, someone in, you know, wherever, Bangladesh, India, is not going to be able to fly over for a 2-day DroidCon event. That is just prohibitively expensive and a huge time sink. So for them to be able to benefit from the same content, I think it's good.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow, that was a tangent. We are actually going to talk about Android. But like, it's something that I care deeply about, the conference connection, sort of getting the content out there. And it's great to see you and the other community of speakers, where you do this interesting thing where you go and you learn deeply about an area and then you teach others about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of classic training model for reasons that escape me. Like, I do it because I want people to get better at writing good Android apps.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I work on Android, obviously. I would care deeply about that. What's your motivation?
I think there's quite a few things, and I think that I know, and this is going to be a little bit gushy, a little bit kind of like emotional, but maybe.
Should we play like the soundtrack?
Yeah,
is this the gushy soundtrack portion of the podcast?
But I mean, so what it is, like, I strongly feel that I wouldn't be, not to say that I'm a great engineer, but I don't think I'd be the engineer that I was today if people didn't, you know, reach out, if people didn't, you know, communicate their problems, their like ideas, their knowledge about things, and put it out there for me to learn. Like, every time I have a problem, I can look it up on Stack Overflow or look up at, you know, in someone's blog post and find an answer. If, you know, I just kind of want to know like the best way of doing something, people put their ideas out there, and that makes me better. That makes me like kind of have a broader experience than I could personally have just doing, you know, my one job, like my one day job. And also just, it, you know, if you're stuck, there's probably someone else out there that has the same problem. So I feel like all of that, like gleaning that knowledge, being able to fix problems, makes me a better engineer. And it only seems fair that I, you know, equally put that out in the world. And also just people are cool. I like meeting people, going out to conferences and talking to other developers, like talking to people that love to do what you do is great. And I just think it just kind of makes the world a little bit better.
So you're saying you want to give back to the community. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I guess that would be the succinct, eloquent way of saying it, rather than a rambly, kind of like slightly fuzzy way of saying it. But sure, you know, say it that way.
it's interesting. It's like the flip side of engineering. Like, one of my taglines is like, none of us got into this business because of our social skills. Like, you don't start spending your entire life with a computer because you're really good with people. But there is a subset of the community. I feel the same. Like, I really enjoy meeting people and spending time with them and learning about what they develop or work on or just having conversations or whatever. But I think that's a bit unusual, right? I think a lot of people are attracted to this field because they really want to spend more quality time with their keyboard. So finding that subset of the community that actually enjoys the more social aspects of sharing information and getting out there, I think is good too.
I think there's like a different aspects of it, well, because I this is kind of like my big thing. I feel like people come to Android from different places. So like computer engineering. I talked to someone yesterday who started embedded systems, but I have buddies who've come from like Java server. And I feel like your previous technologies, where you come from, colors, like how you view Android, your priorities, like what you see as the important parts of development, like how you view performance and how you view different things and how like you approach, I don't know, UI and optimization. And I think it's really beneficial to know where people come from and like getting those different perspectives to kind of inform like how I develop things. Like, maybe I was prioritizing the wrong thing. Maybe I'm looking at like how I build and architect and optimize, not in a wrong way, but maybe in a kind of narrow way. So I think that's one thing that's really interesting also about conferences and community and also just speaking, is like seeing someone else's spin on just different parts of development.
Right.
In Android in particular, and just in general.
So when you see a talk on some new subject area, like somebody gives a talk on, you know, security or web services or whatever it is, that this is a thing that you're not playing with right now, do you then like go back to your room and start banging on this thing and write a sample app around that? Like, how do you learn more about stuff? Because I enjoy sitting through a talk and learning about that new thing, although frankly, I have more than enough to do with my day job that I end up not playing with those new things. But you're on on the other side where you're actually writing applications that could benefit from these other things, right?
It's kind of a tricky question because I think, you know, so I was a contractor, and now I'm actually working for a product company. And I think there's always a desire when you get home from a conference to like open it up, do a code lab, like just play around with something. And I think like I guess 30% of the time that happens. And it kind of depends on what it is. Like you know, there's been a lot of talk about like some of the IoT things and you know like integrate you know like kind of like the new like Google Assistant, Google Home things that we can do with that. And I think to some extent some of those things are a little bit harder and they're more of a time investment, but they're things that we're interested in and we want to try. But then there's things like if you go to just like a really talk like a talk on say architecture or hey, here's some security tips that you can do. You can kind of go home and just like you know go or go to work on Monday and be like, hey, we should try this thing and then kind of integrate that. But then there's also side. It kind of varies. It depends on what it is. But I think we all have this idea to like, I want to go home and try this. But it kind of depends on like this your situation, like whether you want to do it on your own or whether you're kind of doing it in a work situation and kind of what exactly it is you're trying to, you know, do.
It seems like the closer it is to what you're already doing, the easier it is to sort of peel that apple. That's not a metaphor that works at all. Slowly, right? Well, so you can integrate some of that stuff. Like if somebody has a new approach on architecture, maybe you can take a run at that in some portion of your activity, as opposed to like, oh, here's a really cool IoT thing, which I think was really awesome, but how much would I have to learn in order to get to step one there? And then you have to weigh that against, you know, the priorities of your life or your other jobs, right?
Sometimes you know, are the features aren't quite compatible. Like I'm not quite sure how we would integrate IoT in this particular like mobile thing. But you know, it's I mean it's yeah, it's always interesting. And I think sometimes it's always good to go to conferences that kind of they put the seed in your brain that, oh, this is a cool thing I saw. And then, you know, 3 months down the line, you know, you have a problem or you have this feature, it's like, hey, there was this cool thing that we heard about. Let's try that thing. And then, you know, it's sometimes it's delayed, kind of a delayed I guess diving into the pool, but I mean, it's always there. And I think it's always valuable to expose yourself to new things. And even if it's not immediate, at some point, usually an opportunity shows itself. So
Yeah,
that's
it'll
always
be there in
fun.
the back of your mind. Like I kind of feel that with IoT. Like this is really cool, but I'm not sure how to like dip my toes in. The people that I know that don't work on that technology at all, that have taken it on, are basically doing hobby projects at home. Like they'll set up some connected home stuff and start toying around with it there. I personally, like when I get home, I'm like writing comedy or something that has nothing to do with technology, just because on the weekend I want to break from that. But I think that's kind of what you need to do, is sort of take on more than just watching the video in order to really learn how the stuff
Yeah,
works, right?
and I think there's good compromises. Like I was actually talking to a couple of folks where they wanted to play around with the awareness and they wanted to play around with say like Kotlin and like kind of some of the other architectures that are kind of I guess trendy if you want to use that word in our community. And they kind of did it like halfway. They were like they started a side project that it wasn't a personal thing. It was kind of like a professional one, but they used it as a kind of experiment, like as a sandbox. Because you know we you know usually when you're doing a product, since you know you have things in production, you have things that you don't want to mess with, you don't want to like destroy the user experience just because you want to try this new thing. But you know like a nice side project, a sandbox where you can kind of play around with things, see like if it's something that you can integrate and it's something that would be useful. It's always good. So there's kind of like middle grounds too, like you know hey, can we play with this? Like sure, just you know do it over there. You know, for a safe distance away. And then, you know, if it turns out to be something like awesome, then you bring it in. So, yeah.
One of the cool things about doing that is I think it's so much easier to do that now than it was even, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago. Just that all the tools you need, all the technologies you need are available on the systems that you have. Like there are all these free SDKs and libraries and open source projects you can contribute to. The hardware for doing this stuff is relatively cheap, so you can actually take on any of these projects that you want, as opposed to, you know, back in the day, you would need some, you know, dev system with proprietary software, or you need a license for doing this or whatever. So there's so much that you can do. If you want to take on that hobby project, then it's just a matter of the time. So this kind of relates to one of the questions that I had wanted to ask and haven't gotten there after 15 minutes of trying, which is, okay, so the talks that I've seen that you've given include things on like custom views and custom layouts, constraint layout, or something you did at DroidCon London, where it's clear that you saw that there was this new thing, or you needed to try this thing, and so you dove into it. You learned what you needed to the extent that you could then give a really good technical tutorial on doing it. So, how do you learn?
Doing like that is like my 100% like 100% like doing. So I feel like a lot of times it's just it I feel like very few times in my career that it just me personally, this is just like how I've experienced things, is that it's not often that I think of something that I want to do, like say like that I read something in the docs that, oh, I'll try this at work. A lot of time it's just like, okay, I have this thing that I have to do. I'm not quite sure how to do it. Oh, I see. Maybe this custom view thing, or maybe I need to over, you know, maybe override and maybe like play with this little code or override this particular method. Maybe that's what I have to do. I'm not quite sure how to do that. Let's go to Stack Overflow. Oh, okay, see, I'm going back to the docs and learning about, you know, reading this documentation on how like the measure layout and draw traversals work. Okay, so that's how that works. Oh, and then that, like, it's kind of like this weird like discovery where like I'm like spelunking or something, and I kind of start off at the mouth of the cave, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then I find that, you know, I have to go a little bit deeper, and then there's like some cooler stuff deeper down. I'm like, oh, look, there's now some glowworms going on. I'm like, all right, it's kind of like this weird kind of like starting at a point where you have a goal, and then trying to follow that goal. And sometimes it's like a roundabout path, and sometimes it's a very straightforward path. But I think there's a lot to learn as you take these little really weird and windy kind of like detours and trying to figure out, well, what's this thing and how does that work? And then, okay, well, that's not going to exactly solve my problem. How about this thing? It's, yeah, it's just basically screwing up and then trying to figure out how to unscrew up, I think.
Okay, so yeah, I found that too. Like having the goal, having the sample app that you want to write, or the new piece of technology that you want to add to something existing, where like you have a concrete thing you're trying to accomplish. That's like step one, and then you end up in weird places. You know, you do a search, you end up on Stack Overflow or
Yeah.
documentation.
Well, I mean, I can tell you the exact moment when I started to need to learn how, like, say, like, so like one of my talks, I kind of go through like how like view hierarchies are traversed so that they can be drawn, you know, like measure, layout, and draw. And I remember the exact kind of like week where I started learning about that, and it was for a project where I think we had an expandable list view, but it didn't behave exactly how my client wanted, and they weren't exactly like forgiving on me saying, well, this is how this works, and you know, we need to kind of just go with it because it's going to, you know, take up too much time for us to kind of break it open. They're like, no, break it open. All right. And then I
Did you
remember,
explain to them how fragile list view is?
no, well, I
They
tried,
didn't
but you
care.
know, I, you know, th and that's maybe my, though, you know, I was just a little developer. I didn't quite know how to communicate it in a non, you know, like super esoteric way. And so they're like, okay, I'll just do it then. Maybe that's easier than actually trying to communicate with someone. And I just remember, I forgot, and I don't remember exactly where it was, but I remember trying to like maybe animate it or maybe make it behave in a certain way, and getting down to, okay, I need to kind of like intervene somehow between when it expands and when it's like collapsed, but I don't know how to do that. And now I'm putting something in there and it's kind of sized funny. How does this work? And I remember that was exactly when, all right, okay, I know there's this measure thing, and I know there's like a layout thing, and then there's something I have to do like in there somehow. How do I do this? And then from there, I was like, okay, well, what does this function do? And I went into like, I think the view like code or the view group code, and I looked at that, I was like, oh my God, what is all this stuff? And then, you know, like, okay, let me go and find someone who actually knows about this. And that was like the exact moment where like, ah, so like, okay, I get it now. Like, this is how this underlying structure works. And then later on another project, I was like, you know, there was some cool stuff I kind of did that I ended up not putting in production because it was an awful mess, and that we ended up like getting away from the expandable list view anyway, thank goodness. But there was some cool stuff that I learned that maybe I could use on this project that, you know, if we really want to do something really funky and interesting, maybe I can leverage that. And then I went back to it and learned a little bit more. And I think that's just like, I think that's really great too about, you know, Android in particular, not to like, you know, be all Android, but you know,
I'm okay with
open source
that.
platforms, I think,
Yeah.
is kind of an amazing opportunity for you to really learn how things work. And actually, that's one thing I wanted to bring, kind of, I made me think about. When we decided we're deciding we're going to talk, is that right before I did Android, I did Flex, and
Heard of that platform.
yeah, I think you've heard of that. I
Yeah.
think you might be familiar with it, and it was like an exact parallel experience when I was doing Flex, and I was kind of really into. And it's kind of funny because I think there was a really big parallel in that a lot of my development in Flex was doing like custom UI work, and a lot of that centered around something called a life cycle, which you know has, you know, very many parallels to what we do today. And I think that the idea that, you know, I used to do this thing, and I used to know like how this thing worked and how like things would come to life and things would live and then things would die, and that by leveraging that system, by leveraging those events, I could do cool things that maybe weren't in the platform before. And then it was really funny because when I came to Android, I was able to kind of like see that parallel. It's like, oh, this is kind of how, this is a cool way to do things, you know, like learn how they work, break them apart, and then do, you know, other cool things. Because, and I feel like every project I've done, you know, I try to like make it as easy as possible because I'm a lazy developer, and try to use like everything out of the box that I can. But there's going to be an inevitable point where someone asks for something, I want to do something where I have to kind of break something apart and make it do something that it's not like natural for it to do. And I feel like at that point is when I really start learning about how things work, and it makes me better at that platform. I learn like, oh, when I get this exception, this is what's going on, or hey, I added a view at a weird point, so I'm getting this weird like, hey, you called the request layout too many times thing. I'm like, oh, okay, right. So it's kind of like this really weird incremental learning where you screw something up, you look it up, you figure it out, and then the next time you kind of build on that knowledge, and it just makes everything else better.
I mean, and hopefully the information is out there for you to learn. I guess at the end of the day, there's always the source code that you can poke through. Perform traversals in Vue, Groot, Impl is not for the tame. You know, the easily queasy. But all the information is there. We go back and look at that often to, you know, verify the assumptions that we're making internally in the framework. One of the things that's interesting to me in like the talks that we give or the articles that we write or the content that we push in general for Android is not just to say, here's the API, but to try to explain why and how. So like some of the performance talks that we've done at, you know, I/O or the articles that we've written or whatever, it's not about saying, you know, call this API because it's not that simple. Really, the more you understand about why things work this way and how they work, the better able you're going to be to architect your application to not trip over problems, right?
Yeah, and I think that's something especially interesting with mobile because I feel like a lot of times, like, and we have conversations all the time in the Android like community about very high level architecture, which kind of feels like, you know, at this kind of high level, the castles in the sky kind of thing. But when, with mobile devices and kind of like embedded system constrained things that have like resources and other things that you have to manage and be aware of, that understanding when you have problems, understanding why like performance might be slow, understanding why like, you know, connectivity might be bad and being able to compensate for that is kind of, it's important. And I think knowing how things work just aids you in doing that because you can't just stay at this high level. You can't stay up in the clouds where, you know, there's stuff going on, but it doesn't affect me. But on mobile, everything affects you.
Yeah.
And so knowing how it works and understanding where you can go to find problems and fix them is just so much more important.
Right. Yeah. Because otherwise, like if you fling your list and it's incredibly slow and you're running at 10 frames a second and you don't understand anything about Android, like where do you start?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, there's tools to diagnose it, but basically you need to learn about those tools somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand the different elements that contribute to it so that when you look at the information from the tools, you can go, oh, I mean, obviously I'm running a layout during my animation frame. I probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like I mean, not to like, you know, rag on people who love talking about architecture and high level things. I love it too, but I think it's like a thing about like best laid plans, and then I think in real life stuff happens. Sorry, and you end up having to do things that kind of go kind of counter to what your perfect plans. You have to kind of engineer things to make it work, like. Because we're like on different devices and because, you know, things happen and things don't, you know, work exactly the way you expect them on different devices and on different versions, that you kind of have to be like a little more fluid and kind of accept that things aren't going to be 100% beautiful, but they have to work. And I feel like, again, understanding how like the underlying system works allows you to kind of have like your beautiful architected thing, but still be able to kind of make it, kind of fix holes and I guess like put band-aids where things like where real life kind of starts interceding kind of on your best laid plans.
Because they're still constrained devices, especially since, yeah, you may have one of the whizzy new devices in your pocket, but chances are your users don't, or they're several versions back or whatever. So how do you make it work in a general case in what can be very constrained and limiting situations?
Yeah, totally.
So let's get slightly more technical. So some of the stuff that I've heard you talk about more recently is custom view, custom layout stuff, as well as constraint layout. More immediately recent, if that's a phrase.
Recenter.
More recenter. So what had you look at constraint layout? Are you using that in your project or you just wanted to learn about it?
So like performance and kind of like layouts is kind of like one of my things. I think I've always enjoyed UI and I like building things that face someone. I think that's why I kind of moved away from computer engineering and did more like apps, is that I like the idea that someone is impacted very directly by something I do. So I've always been a UI nut, and I think that kind of led me to being a layout nut. And I'm also kind of just I'm a nice person, but I'm also inside, I'm deep inside, I'm extremely opinionated. So I remember kind of just being on projects where, you know, people would, you know, make layouts and I feel like, so to kind of back up a little bit, like, I feel like layouts are an important part of building Android applications. And I feel that, I think despite that it's being UI, I feel like we always have this kind of like inclination to kind of either get things done or to like and also in addition to kind of organize things and software design things in a really great way. And I feel like I've been on projects where I see this kind of like tension between let's get this done and let's make it look the way it's supposed to look, and at the same time this tension with, well, let's make it nicely architected and let's make it kind of clean and let's make it kind of like easily maintainable and extensible. And I kind of saw a lot of really interesting phenomenons just in particular with layouts. And at a very base level, like XML files, and kind of like at a broader level, like layouts and just kind of like how they perform and how we kind of implement them. And that just kind of just really fascinated me. And it's just like from little things to why do certain screens scroll better than others? And, you know, like to like, why are you doing this way? Why don't you do it this way? And why is this file such a mess with things everywhere when it seems like such a simple thing? So I'm kind of fascinated just by like how to do layouts. And I kind of always take it as like an engineering challenge to kind of build layouts in the most efficient, lazy way possible. So I kind of have all these kind of like fascinations with this kind of thing. And now I kind of forgot where I was going with that.
Why constraint layout?
Why constraint layout? So I've been talking a lot about performance in the last year. I kind of had this big talk. And again, it was kind of a talk that came from things that really annoyed me. So like someone, instead of using a linear layout, taking a relative layout and saying A goes above B, B goes above C, C goes above D. And that just annoyed me because it kind of just like, why didn't you just use this other thing? So you didn't have to like, you know, like implement all these resources and
Let
add
the
all these
record
attributes.
show that I'm crying.
But you know, I've seen this more than once,
Yeah.
and I didn't
Because it's
understand it.
easier, probably because we give it to them by default in the templates.
Well, that, and I think someone heard a thing that someone said about relative layout being better than nested linear layouts, things like that. But and I think the intention is good, but I think that there, and I was like, why are you doing this? Well, this person said that this thing was bad. I was like, but what? That doesn't make sense. And so I kind of started researching that and understanding like the context of that. And it's a lot more, and I thought it was fascinating that it's a lot more, it's not black and white, like this layout is bad, this layout is good.
Right.
It's like situational.
Depends on what you're doing.
Depends on what you're doing. And then that got me into, hey, you know, like there's situations where you don't necessarily want to make something organizationally beautiful where you have this layout laid out and that layout because you think it kind of, you know, makes sense in terms of like the organization of the screen. It's sucky because you have like about five different levels and you're nesting things and nesting things and nesting things. And that kind of like catapulted me into, okay, how do I make this better? So I did a couple of talks kind of explaining like, okay, this is why you might not want to nest so much. This is the actual impact it might have. And these are things, some things you can do it better. And then I think it was interesting because I think constraint layout, when it came out, that when it was announced at I/O, I mostly just saw the UI builder. And I kind of like, I said this in my talk and I'll admit it freely that I've a huge prejudice against WYSIWYG builders just because they've sucked. Like in every platform I've worked on, they sucked. I did iOS for a while. I didn't like the fact that I was like, you know, forced to do it for certain things. So I think I've always had this bias against them. And so when I first saw it, I was like, oh, why are we doing this? This is not what we do, you know?
So actually, as a callback to Flex, I remember working on the Flex platform, and there was this feeling that we had a design editor, design view maybe we called it, that was pretty good. I would say it was better than like pre-constraint layout design view stuff that we used to have on Android. Like it actually worked reasonably well, but still people weren't doing it. The people that like beginner developers would use it. It was their first introduction to
That's
how to
not, yeah, me
design a
too.
UI. And then as soon as they wanted to do anything real, they would just dip down into
Yeah, and I think that really, I think that stuck in my head. And I was like, I think that there were things like, well, I was looking a little bit like that other IDE that that other platform uses. Bleh. Sorry. And but at the same time, I was like, huh, kind of interesting. So is it like relative layout? Like, what's the point of this? And I think I kind of had a realization actually listening to an episode of this podcast, listening to like Nicolas and John and Romain talk about like the motivations behind it. That, oh, you know, like this thing that you've been talking about to other people that you have been saying about, you know, like flattening things and reducing nesting, that's what that's for. And I was like, oh, okay, right on. And so as I kind of like looked into it more, explored it more, I was like, no, that no, this is exactly what people should be doing. And I really like this idea of expressiveness. And I think that a lot of that is like really at the root of what I talk about and what is interesting to me is how do we express layouts? How do we build relationships between little individual items on a screen to build an experience? And that I think that the constraint layout is starting to kind of, I guess, maybe be a more interesting way of articulating those relationships at the same time building more performance. And it's really funny because I feel like everybody always asks about performance. So like I talk about performance, about layouts, but then people ask me about performance and they said, well, how does this directly compare to this other thing? And they always think about numbers. Like everybody wants to know like the, I don't know, like how fast is, how literally how many milliseconds does this take from that take? And I think what I really like about constraint layout is that it's not about necessarily numbers and like this in this particular situation is faster than this layout in this particular situation, but the idea that you're giving developers more power to be expressive, but in a more concise, maybe elegant way, which might be a little bit flowery of saying it. But so I think that there's a lot of kind of things that made me like constraint layout. And just like flattening hierarchies is just one thing, but it's more of an idea of like, and Nicola said this much more succinctly, so I'm going to copy what he said, but separating layout hierarchy from view hierarchy and kind of like looking at views in a different way, in a more efficient way.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a very rambly way of looking at things, but there's just like a lot, there's just like a lot about it that I think is valuable.
It's interesting. We, and when I say we, I mean the constraint layout team, has been looking into layout performance recently because like they're building this thing that has some more overhead than some of the layouts that you may be using if you're using, you know, deep nesting of linear layouts. Those are pretty darn simple unless you're using weights. And so it's a concern, of course. Okay, well, if you're building an overhead, how much are you building in? And they keep running more and more tests on this stuff. And like, frankly, once we got to art and modern devices, the amount of time spent in a layout for any reasonable layout situation is actually not where your bottleneck is.
Yeah.
And so to some extent, like, as you said, like the raw numbers on layout are really not where the problem is. It's what's the problem you're trying to solve? How much overhead are you building in? And how elegant is that, you know, XML code going to be, or how the design view that you have in this, or the code that you interact with, like, can we build the UI that we meant to without jiggering things in such a way that it's incredibly fragile? You know, now we have a new form factor, and oh my God, we got to rebuild all this stuff. It's like, no, can you design the layout that's actually going to be what you want it to be in all situations, and do so with relatively small overhead for stuff?
And I think that, and as being someone who is kind of anti-WYSIWYG, for, you know, whatever my reasons, I think I got turned around in the idea that it's not just about performance and efficiency as well, but it's also being able to understand what the heck is going on.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, and I'm a person who always said to myself, I can do it faster in XML, whatever. But I think working in teams and, you know, trying to build UIs that are kind of like extensible, maintainable, requires you to understand what's going on and understand relationships and how things are structured. And a lot of times, like, let's be honest, if you look at a relative layout with a whole bunch of stuff in it, you can't just look at the file and say, all right, so this has a relationship with this view, and that one has a relationship with that view. And if I kind of like mess with this one, then this whole bottom section goes to heck because it's relying on this one.
Right.
And I think what really got me maybe thinking more less biased in a less biased way about WYSIWYG is that really it's not just about layout efficiency; it's about developer efficiency, and maybe even being able to kind of communicate and, you know, lay things out better, be able to kind of better implement designs because you have a more visual way of doing it. And I think that integrating it with a tool is really smart because it's more expressive and because it can do, again, the things that relative layout can do and as well as some other things. It's more important to keep all that under control. You need to be able to see what's going on very quickly. And I think that what really hit me is that, a UI builder, especially something with like the new layout editor that has like a blueprint view that you can see connections, allows you to glean information much quicker, and that makes you more efficient as a developer. And it allows you to things like if you have multiple people working on a single layout on a team, I think it just makes it just more efficient. Like if you are trying to implement like material design with like consistent key lines and consistent styling, not styling so much, but like consistent like key lines and making things sure that things are positioned as prescribed, whatever
one
the
of those.
One
we'll
of
say
the,
them both
whatever the
works.
Right scribe is. That it's easier to do that as a team when you have kind of visual indications of that.
Right.
Because I've been on teams where I really want to follow key lines here, folks. Let's like do this dimension thing and that. And then someone comes in and just plops something in.
Right.
But I'm imagining like if I had just had like, say, a tool like constraint layout where I have guidelines, where I have arrows pointing to different things, someone can say, oh, I see there's a relationship here.
Right.
There's, you know, this is where things should be. I will follow suit. And so it allows for better consistency and just, I mean, I've opened up layout files that I've never looked at that maybe five people looked at, and I have no idea where to start with this. But whereas like going at it in a more visual sense, like, all right, this is the thing that I need. Let me drill down to that. And so again, efficiency, not just in layout, but for the developer as well.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, the team aspect, but also it's the ability to visualize, to give you a mental model of the layout. Like, and I think one of the keys to doing that is that the tool was developed hand in hand with the underlying layout itself instead of like, you know, sort of shoehorned in after the fact, which is one of the reasons that it didn't really work well to begin with on the other layouts, so that you can actually round trip it. So if you want to write XML, that's great. Go knock yourself out with XML. but you're using all the attributes that it's going to rely on in the tool, and the tool can give you just a different view into that same information. Not only you, but somebody else on your team, or they wrote something in the design view. You can see it in a design view. You can hack it in XML. Whatever is most comfortable to you, but the ability to actually get the mental model of what's going on instead of like with a complicated relative layout, just looking at the XML, scratching your head and wondering what's going on, or even seeing the design view, but not getting the same information from it because it just wasn't developed with that model in mind, and so we're not necessarily exposing all of the relationships in the same way. Interesting. So do you now use primarily the design view?
I think that
you go back and forth.
Yeah. I think a lot of things, and I think that's the same thing with performance, is that everything is about being pragmatic and like doing as much as you, doing as only as much as you need when you need to do it. So I think that we have a lot of, I say this too when I would talk about efficient layouts, is that if your layout is fine, don't bend over backwards like doing these things that I'm telling you to do. But if you are having problems, or if you are approaching a situation where you do have something really complex and really dense, like in terms of data or interaction or whatever, consider doing it. And so I think nowadays, it's kind of like a good integration. I'm really excited to use the new UI tools and use constraint layout. But I think where it fits, where I've kind of have really simple things where it might be a little bit lighter for me, if I have a linear layout to just plop something in, I'll probably just do that. Just because me personally as a developer, I think I'm so attuned to doing things a certain way. In this situation, I'm faster at that. It's faster for me to change the weights real quickly in XML from this and that to this and that. But I think if I am starting especially if I'm starting something new, or especially if I'm trying to move something that is complex to something a little more manageable, I will probably go back to go to using the UI builder.
It's a good example. A lot of the stuff that we do in the platform, and by which I mean, it could be in the tools, it could be in support library, it could be in framework. But when we come out with new stuff, that doesn't mean rewrite your application around this new stuff. It's more like, here's a powerful new thing for you to use when it makes sense. So when we came out with a recycler view, obviously we felt a lot more strongly about, this is an architecture to build on than list view because of all the fragile problems, and there's not much that we can do with this. But we're not telling people to stop using list view. If you have an application that uses list view, great. That we're not telling you to rip it out and replace it. It's going to be a lot of work, and maybe there are things about list view that you enjoy in your current application that you'd have to figure out a different way of doing it with recycle view. So no, absolutely don't do that. Same thing with the constraint layout. We're not saying, hey, use this new beta thing because it's far better than anything else you're using. A, it depends on the situation, and B, it's not worth ripping apart an application to force feed this thing in there unless you just want to play around with new tools. But when you're doing something new, especially when it's more involved, or if you're doing a lot of interaction with designers where, they're handing you mocks and you're having to tie yourself in knots trying to figure out how to nest layouts or deal with relative layout, then it's time to consider, trying this new thing.
Yeah, just, be lazy. Yeah. Only do it when you have to.
I was curious specifically about, so you've obviously looked into a lot of different layout situations, including relative layout. Mm-hmm. When you think of constraint layout capabilities compared to relative layout, what's the selling point? What's the interesting part for you besides the tool portion of it?
I just think that there's, I like the, I think that, hold on, give me a second. I'm going to think about this. I think that it, I was, I'll be really honest. I never really liked relative layout. A lot of times it just felt kind of clumsy to me. Because I feel like a lot of times, the relationships that it lets you build, it kind of starts out with very simple, relative layout, starts with really simple relationships. But I think a lot of times it kind of escalates very quickly into very complex relationships where I want this one centered this way, but then to the left of this view, and then this one is going to be, it just feels like it's a very kind of it just escalates really quickly.
Is it because it's like one-to-one?
It's like one-to-one.
So you end up having like a chain.
Yeah, and then, but I think in constraint layout, I think I find it more interesting to think about it that way. And I think I just kind of like, and it's really the same thing in the end. I think that it's really just a different phrasing for a little bit on how you position things and how things are constrained.
Yeah.
But I kind of just like the way that things are phrased now, or just the way that things are, I guess the metaphors used that we use now to build relationships are a little bit more interesting. I like the idea that, oh, here's an edge constraint, rather than calling it necessarily this is to the left of that and that's to the left of that. This is just like this is constrained to this side of that. And then instead of saying, oh, this is centered in the parent, this is you're building the center constraint I think it's just more expressive and a little bit less, it's just more expressive and a little more, in a sense, it's a little more general, but in that, it's Anyway, I just like the way that the language that it uses better, and I think that it's forcing me to think about things a little bit differently.
Right.
And also, it seems like with constraint layout, because it's constraint based, it really does make you think more about kind of not just relationships between widgets, but also spacing, and like how do you want this piece to kind of fill up the space, and how do you want this to kind of be laid out here?
Right.
Whereas in relative layout, again, it kind of feels a lot of it is like because it allowed you some flexibility, but it had a very kind of like rigid way of doing it, left, right, top, bottom, you know, like centered, that it kind of became hard to kind of describe certain situations. Whereas I think constraint layout kind of gives you all that, but also makes it broad enough that you can kind of think about things a little bit differently. I don't know. I don't have a good way of explaining it, but there's like other tools that I like as well. Like the dimension ratio thing. Like I love being able to describe things in a more like high level, kind of like natural way. Like, rather than like the dimension ratio thing where you can actually constrain one side to the other side based on a ratio. I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really powerful, again, because of understanding and also for cleanliness, is that rather than you go off and you write a custom view, like a custom like image view override that always keeps things in aspect ratio, you can just say, hey, I want the height to match like a 16:9 ratio.
Yeah.
And I think that's just really powerful. And I think that it just helps us communicate better as a developer, and it allows you to kind of be more succinct in how you want things to be laid out, rather than kind of this messy like, okay, well, measure this side and like reorient this way and add this padding and like doing all these things kind of like in a much more low level, kind of like direct, maybe blunt way. Is
yeah.
that there's a little bit more elegance to it. So I don't know. It's just I have very like high flowery ways I get to think about layouts, so it doesn't quite come out very technical.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Like I haven't used it to the extent that I'd be familiar with, like the difference in the language. The main thing I think of is the introduction to key lines, which I think, especially after like material design came
That's
out,
true,
we
yeah.
started thinking about
mm-hmm.
you know these key lines and the dip grid and stuff like that. Like that is a pain to deal with, I think, with traditional layouts, including
mm-hmm.
relative layout. Like we have margin. That's why it's there, but that means you have to feed that margin into like all your
yeah.
views or into some container view that you're putting in there just for that or whatever. Whereas this actually gives you the same concept in the design view or in the XML.
Yeah, it's all like high level, and I think that's always like the goal, right? Like I think when I was setting, I think someone once said to me that like our whole job is like abstracting everything. Like our job is like basically building abstractions, and I think it's kind of interesting that we usually talk about abstractions from like a code side and like back-end stuff and business logic, but I kind of like constraint layout because in a lot of ways it's abstracting things that we think about from UI, you know, like thinking at things at a little more high level, not just thinking, all right, this has 16 DP margin, this has 16 DP margin, this is 16 DP margin, and that's how I implement key lines. But now I have this thing, and this is my key line, and these things are kind of aligned to this. So again, it's a lot more higher level, cleaner
right.
way of talking about things. And so that, you know, your teammate doesn't come in and put something in at 32 DP because he didn't actually read the rest of the
right.
attributes. And
or
things like
or
that.
You don't round trip with your designer, and then they change what that margin is, and now everything's off, and you have to adjust one
yeah,
by one.
And
it's like, no, you're actually working on the same
yeah,
model.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, too, that it allows like the workflow between design and developer to get even easier. Because things are at a high level, you can communicate
yep.
those things better instead of saying, yeah, I don't know, just speaking at higher level terms is always better, I think, for design and planning.
So I have dominated your time for quite a long time, and there's actually other stuff to see here today. So we will wrap it up here. I don't know
cool.
if you wanted to end on any particularly wise insights.
Just try things out. And I mean, like, just I'm always into like trying things. If you have a problem that you have to do, if there's something interesting that you want to implement in a design or in a UI rather, just do it. Try to do it. If it doesn't work, try something else. If you break it, try to fix it. And I feel like that's just like the best way to learn, and just be crazy. I don't know. I think trying crazy things allows you to discover things that you didn't know before, and that a lot of times I think trying crazy things allows you to come up with ideas or come up with tools or come up with like ways of doing things that other people can benefit from as well, I think. I don't know.
I usually feel like computer science is really poorly named because I think of it as more creativity and less like science where, you know, everything is sort of known. We're not coming in and putting our engineer's stamp of approval on code or anything. We're just not trained that way. And the problems that we're solving, like by definition, we're building new territory all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're solving research problems as part of what we do every day and writing code. Like, I don't know how to solve that problem, but I'm going to bang away on a prototype until I can get my mind around it, and then I'm going to write the code that actually fixes the problem. So to me, it's not really a science, but in this aspect, it is. Like, it is trial and error. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try that thing. It's not going to work, and we're going to do better by screwing up, right? We're going to try that. It's going to fail, but in failing, I will learn more about it, and then I will try something else that will probably also fail. But then eventually, we get to the solution that we want.
Yeah.
So maybe science, at least in that tiny aspect, is well-deserved.
Yeah, maybe my whole point was, don't be afraid to screw up, as long as you fix it.
Yeah, eventually. Screw up and then check it in. That's what she said. Okay, all right.
Commit all the bugs.
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.